this was a problem that was relatable, that people had experienced, but it was something that was in the margins. It was something you talked about with your girlfriends, but convincing people that it was an economic issue, not a personal issue, was not as easy as I thought it was going
to
be.
Welcome to Meet the Leader, a podcast where top leaders share how they're tackling the world's toughest challenges. In today's episode, we talk to Reshma Soojani, serial founder from Girls Who Code and Moms First. She'll share why leaders who care about productivity will need to keep their team's families top of mind. Subscribe to Meet the Leader on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. I'm Linda Lacina from the World Economic Forum, and this is Meet the Leader.
The world I am proposing is not a utopia, it's Belgium.
You might know Reshma Soojani from Girls Who Code. That's a nonprofit that she started in 2012 to help get more girls into tech careers. But the pandemic shone a big, unflattering light on a gap of a different kind, the caregiving gap. Women often take on unpaid labor like childcare and household chores. But with daycares closed and schools remote, women took on these roles while trying to hold down full-time jobs. That juggle has never been easy, but during the pandemic, it was simply impossible. Millions of women left the workforce worldwide, and many still haven't returned. That care gap was so stark, in the first year of the pandemic, December 2020, Reshma founded Moms First. That's a movement to land paid care for childcare in as many places as humanly possible. The group has already developed a special AI-powered tool, one with a little help from her friend Sam Altman, and it has helped thousands of women in New York State understand their options and eligibility for paid leave, keeping them at work, and keeping food on the table. She shared what is needed to scale that work further. But critically, she shared how the world would be different with paid leave in place. Spoiler alert, it is a place where we are on pace to bridge the gender gap, since more women are poised for leadership roles. It's also a world that's better prepared for a very real labor shortage that's right around the corner. She'll talk about all of this, including why launching a tool for moms is a little harder than launching a nonprofit for girls. But first, I'll have her talk more about Moms First and how it got started.
Yeah, so Moms First is a movement to pass paid leave and childcare and get it in as many places and spaces as possible. And it was founded because oftentimes in America, we treat moms as their social safety net. When everything broke down during the pandemic and daycares were shut down and schools were shut down, it was moms, right, who both did the unpaid labor and kept their full-time jobs. And, you know, this happens again in a moment where, you know, America is the only industrialized nation that doesn't have paid leave. So the vast majority of women go back to work several weeks after having a baby. America is the wealthiest nation that spends the least amount in childcare. That means that 40% of parents go into debt to pay for childcare. They pay more for their childcare than they pay for their mortgage. And so when we think about why the United States has the most educated population of women that have the least amount of participation in the labor market, it's not because we don't have confidence. It's not because we don't have enough mentors or sponsors or that, you know, we didn't do enough power poses. It's because we don't have the structural change that we need as women and as mothers. And that means paid leave, childcare, and equal pay for equal work.
One of the early names for Moms First was the Marshall Plan for Moms. And I like that language. Can you tell me why you chose Marshall Plan for Moms?
Because it felt like during the pandemic, right, what happened is that 11 million women were pushed out of the workforce. So when we started the pandemic in the United States, it was the first time that there were more women in the workforce than men. You know, we were flying our feminist flags high. And then the pandemic happened. And because daycare centers were shut down and schools were shut down, moms couldn't rely on grandparents to come in and take care of their siblings or their caregivers or their nannies or teachers. And so they had to both maintain their full-time paid work and their unpaid labor. And it wasn't tenable. And so you saw 11 million women get pushed out of the workforce and our participation got back to where it was in 1989. And so I remember thinking to myself, wow, it took us, you know, decades and decades to get to the point where we were actually at parity. And so we can't think that this is an on and off switch. Right? It's going to take years to get back to where we were before the pandemic. And so I remember thinking to myself, like, what's the plan? Like, what's the plan? And that's where this, I wrote an op-ed called We Need a Marshall Plan for Moms, you know, again, kind of taking from World War II when you had bombed out cities and you needed a real kind of 360 plan to think about how we were going to do economic recovery. And it felt like we needed the same thing for America's mothers and, quite frankly, mothers across the globe.
Well, I think what's interesting about the term Marshall Plan for Moms is also that it sort of conjures up, hey, like we're in a crisis,
yeah.
Right? There's news here. So I think that, to me, is what's really, really helpful about that, to sort of get people to pay attention. We have Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
Oh.
And, you know, it's so interesting that you say that, because now we're years away from the pandemic and we still haven't made those structural changes. And so mothers are still struggling to stay in the labor market. So many of them have downshifted their careers, changed jobs, are barely hanging on. We have a mental health crisis for mothers in the United States, where alcoholism rates, you know, I mean, drug rates have skyrocketed, suicide rates have skyrocketed, you know, higher than they've ever been. Moms realize, you know, before the pandemic, I think so many people thought, well, if I'm not able to balance my career and my family, something's wrong with me. I married the wrong person. I just don't have good organization skills. Now you realize, wait, it's not me. It's the structure. It's the policies in this nation do not support me. And you're looking around and you're looking for help. You're looking to be seen. And I think that is why now so many mothers in some ways have moved into consciousness of understanding that the system is broken and that something needs to be done.
Moms First launched a first of its kind AI tool called Paid Leave AI.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, what it does?
So, you know, I was wearing two of my hats, you know, founder of Girls Who Code, built the largest movement of women in tech, and then thinking about how do I bring about childcare and paid leave, and how do I get that passed in America? And, you know, we're having this conversation about artificial intelligence, and we're talking about risks, and we're talking about safety concerns, and all of those are very valid. And we're also talking about how artificial intelligence, you know, if it does replace workers' jobs, the money that you get, you know, from AI can be used towards basic income, that's the way you actually close the poverty gap. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, like, what if you actually use Gen AI to close the poverty gap in and of itself as a tool? What I wasn't seeing at that moment was any kind of public sector solutions using generative AI. And I thought about the work that I was doing on paid leave and how in my state, New York is one of the 13 states that offers paid leave in America. But the problem is in New York, the uptake of paid leave is only 20%. And what I mean by that is only 20% of those that are eligible for paid leave actually apply to get them. And the reason is, as you go on our state website, and it's so confusing and complicated. And if you're a single mom working in retail and you have 15 minutes to figure this out, you just give up. And so many people give up, which means that food doesn't get put on the table because they lose that $10,000 in wages that they would have received, you know what I mean, or gotten in benefits, and now have to take out, you know, take their vacation days or sick days or lose those wages. And secondly, what happens is the lack of uptake is leading to the failure to pass a federal bill, because people in Washington say, well, wait a minute, why should paid leave be, you know, one of the top three things we spend our budget on, when if I look at the states that do offer it, people aren't taking advantage of it. It must mean that they don't really want it. And so that's why having high levels of uptake is critical for the federal passage. I pinged my friend Sam Altman, you know, at OpenAI.
As one does.
And I said, I have an idea. And he was like, I love it. And, you know, connected me to the team. And then they collected us to this amazing, you know, development team called Novi. And we kind of got our heads together. We had some focus groups with moms. We dug in and we said, what could something look like that would actually really help parents? And we launched paidleave.ai, you know, we launched it just for New York State in December. And, you know, basically within the first few days, we had 25,000 parents get on the website. It had just gone viral. And you realize that so many moms said to me, you know what? Thank you for this. Like, I didn't feel like I could go into my employer's office and ask the questions that I had on how to apply. Or, and I just found out that I was pregnant and I was terrified or confused. And so when you go to paidleave.ai, it offers you a bunch of prompts in every language, which is also really, really important and powerful. I just found out I'm having a baby. My employer offers some paid leave. How many months do I get? And so it very simply tells you, are you eligible? How much money can you put in your pockets? And it gives you an action plan of what to do next.
What is needed to scale that further?
Well, we're going to scale it further in all 13 states, you know, that do actually offer it in DC. Now, you know, a couple of things like I learned from building this and putting this out there in the world. The first thing is that government does a really bad job at customer service. And generative AI can actually do a great job in increasing trust between citizen and governments. Right? By enabling you to get the benefits that your taxpayer dollars, quite frankly, have paid for. The second thing I learned is that this tool is applicable to so many different things, like the earned income tax credit or SNAPs or healthcare, you know what I mean? Or unemployment insurance, right? And so that one of the things that we wanted to do by launching this tool was to inspire others to innovate. Like AI will only be as good as we are. And so if we sit in the fear, right, of the concerns that we have about AI, and that prevents us from innovating, we're not going to actually make progress. And that's my third point. Like, I believe that AI can do so much good. I think it can solve our biggest problems. And I think it can empower women, people of color, poor people, right, who don't often have access to technology, to be on the front line of creating the next set of tools. And so we want to expand this across all 13 states, but we also want to dig in and prove and show that the tool does increase the uptake of benefits. It does actually fix pain points for families that are navigating the website, whether they're in New York or in California or in New Jersey or in, you know, Minnesota, which are other states that are offer paid leave or will be offering paid leave. And then we want to put a numerical value on that. So it's not just the $10,000 in wages that you'll get because now you got that benefit, but all the downstream and upstream benefits that you have that you can actually economically measure on better health outcomes for families, better job outcomes for families. What is the amount of money that we're really saving, and how good of a job are we doing in closing the inequality gap by these tools?
If this tool were available in all 50 states, what would change in the U.S.?
So there's only 13 states that have paid leave, so it can only be available in 13 states.
Let's imagine this fantasy science fiction world.
I mean, it would change the lives of millions and millions of families. It would help them put food on the table. It would help them, you know, not have to choose between taking care of their careers and taking care of their families, right? It would give them the resources that they need to put their kids in school. Buy them toys for Christmas, right? Change the trajectory of their lives. I think it would build a movement of people that would fight for federal paid leave, you know, that would fight for better care policies for families. Because they would realize, because, you know, the thing is like when you get paid leave is not just about, I just had a baby and now I can have time. Paid leave is also when my father is dying and I need those 2-3 weeks to be able to take care of him and make sure that I help him pass from life to death. You know what I mean? In a moral, humane way. Those are moments in life that you never forget. And if you are able to be given those moments in life, you know, from a perspective of compassion and morality, you want other people to have those moments too. And that's what we need right now. You know, right now there is consensus between Democrats and Republicans that want paid leave, that want affordable childcare, that want good care policies. But there isn't the will, you know what I mean, to actually pass this, because I think our legislators in Washington and even across the globe are just not prioritizing what families want. So that movement of people needs to get real loud and real big.
It was interesting you said that. I wonder too, what do you think the impact to the U.S. economy, but also sort of just retention for women, because they're not in this binary position where they have a life milestone moment, whatever that is, and they feel like, well, I'll just need to leave my job.
You know, I'm reading Claudia Golden's book. She just won the Nobel Peace Prize, right, on her work that she's done on career and women. She answers the question, right, which is like, you know, the United States has the most educated population of women that have the lowest participation in the labor market. And like I said, it's not because of we don't have enough skills or we're not confident enough. It has to do with the fact that the vast majority of us, by the time we're 40, 80% of us will become mothers. And we've never created a workforce or a workplace or society that allows you to balance both of these identities. We force you to pick one or the other, right? And that has kind of led to this moment where we have the lowest amount of participation. We have all of this turbulence, you know what I mean, that women feel. And I think when you pass these policies, that begins, and you focus on passing these policies, that begins to shift.
You'd mentioned that, hey, maybe one of the benefits of this is also that it can inspire people to create other tools. We're still at a point where we're at a little bit of a skill gap with AI. People need to learn up how they can contribute, how they can bring themselves to it. Yeah. In your mind, somebody listening to this, what should they be exploring, doing? you founded Girls Who Code, but there's also some people who might not need to do programming in order to contribute. Somebody listening to this, how can they upskill themselves to help?
I love this. I mean, one of the things I love about this tool too is that, so right now there's a gender gap between people who have actually used ChatGPT before, right? So I think it's like 48% of men, 36% of women. And what I love about paidleave.ai is the vast majority of those using it are women. And if you go in the comment section on Instagram, it's like, oh my God, I never thought I'd understand Gen AI, and I do now because I just use it. So it's like you're taking what people have kind of built up as something that they don't understand or cannot do and demystifying it. And so I think people should go to paidleave.ai and play around with it and understand what Gen AI is. Secondly, you know, this is some of the things that we're talking about at Girls Who Code. We all have to get better at prompt engineering, because if Gen AI kind of takes over the world, humans are going to be only as good as we know how to prompt. Right. And so that's like an upskill that people need to really learn is what are the questions that I should ask to really make sure that AI can augment my intelligence?
In general, as leaders or even as workers, people running our own careers, the questions that we ask are sort of imperative to the answers we seek in life. In your mind, what's needed for that? To ask the right questions?
What's needed to ask the right questions, I think, is for us to continue to stay kind of in relationship with one another. You know, I think about my 8-year-old son who's just like on his, you know, playing games all day long, right? Part of where I learned what questions to ask or I learned about curiosity is in my interactions with other humans. You know, so we have to stay present with one another. We have to stay in community with one another. And I do think that as AI begins to kind of be a part of every aspect of our life, we are going to have to teach people what prompts to ask.
Are there AI tools that can help working parents that they should look into?
So, well, there's starting to be a lot. There's a handful of tools, for example, that are going to help close the cognitive labor gap or the unpaid labor gap, like Milo, you know, and OHI, which are going to help parents give them more time by using Gen AI to kind of take care of some of the tasks that they don't have to do. I think you're seeing a lot more tools, you know, Parent GPT helps you kind of ask questions about breastfeeding or how do I get my baby to sleep. You're seeing a lot more tools, which I think are important on education. Emily Oster, who's a friend of mine, just released a tool called Zelma, right? Which is going to help parents decide, you know, what school they should choose. Because, you know, listen, every parent I know, you know, since the pandemic is really focused on like the opportunity gaps that they're seeing in their kids' education. And if you have an AI tutor that can really focus on the gap that your child has, that can help upskill them very fast.
You had already built a successful organization for women when you had went into Moms First, but still building anything has unexpected obstacles, barriers, things like that. Was there a moment where you hit a wall in building the paid leave AI? You know, how did you get through it? Was there a moment like that?
Well, I mean, I think there was definitely a moment where you want to do a lot of different things. Right. And I think we had to step back and say, OK, what if I had to go on? What's the simplest thing that I can deliver to parents? And we're like, OK, what would I really want to know? OK, I want to know, am I eligible or not? Do I get it or do I not get it? And if I get it, how much money am I getting? And then can you help me? Like, give me an action plan or like, what are the next steps? And I think in the beginning, you know, we did some focus groups with moms. There are lots of things that you want to solve for. And, you know, we took a look at the prototype, like, wait, this is too confusing. And look, I still would say that we're still kind of in the beta phase in terms of like, as we go out to the next 13 states, it's going to iterate and iterate and iterate. It's going to get better and better and better. It's going to get more and more and more effective. I think the other thing is measurement is very important to me. Like, everything I've built, I've been able to clearly say, am I doing well at this? What's the ROI on this? You know, what are my KPIs? And so on this tool, I didn't want to just release something that was really interesting and great to talk on podcasts or conversations like this. I wanted to actually change lives. And so now we're really kind of drilling down on like, how can we actually measure the dollars that we're putting into people's pockets? For me, as a social entrepreneur, though, you know, as I was building Moms First generally, I was coming off of building Girls Who Code. I had built, you know, one of the largest women and girls nonprofits in the world. I'd raised $100 million over 10 years. My team and I had kind of shifted the narrative and the conversation of girls and technology. And I came into building Moms First. I was like, oh, this is going to be easy. I know how to do this. And it was a real eye-opener, right? That in many ways, solving the problems of moms is different than solving the problems of girls. It's often easier to get people to invest in helping girls than it is in helping women. This was a problem that was relatable that people had experienced, but it was something that was in the margins. It was something you talked about with your girlfriends, but convincing people that it was an economic issue, not a personal issue, was not as easy as I thought it was going to be. You know, you had to really figure out how you communicated something in a simple way that people could understand and communicate it in a way that wasn't so big. You know, there were so many moments I would stand in a room full of like 10,000 moms and they would look at me like I was nuts. And I would say, you know, the world I am proposing is not a utopia, it's Belgium. You know what I mean? It's the Netherlands, it's Sweden, it's Canada. But for so long, right, I think if you have experienced motherhood in a certain way, you don't think you deserve more. And really, and for me, thinking about kind of what I needed to do or say to help make that shift in people's consciousness was definitely something I've spent a lot of sleepless nights trying to just have that aha, unlock moment. And that's why I think tools like paidleave.ai, you know, to have Sam Altman and OpenAI, like this be one of the things that they're building, to have Sam be like, paid leave, that's, we should fix that, is really critical, right? Because, you know, he's the leader that people really respect. And so, again, I think it's like I've learned a lot. I understand why sometimes people don't do this a second time around. You know what I mean? Because it's hard, right? But I, every day I wake up so grateful to like work on a topic that I feel so passionately about. I see that hope is on the horizon. I see that change is on the horizon. I see that it's coming. And I feel so grateful that I get to dedicate my minutes, my hours, and my time on making change that is going to happen.
People listening to this, leaders listening to this, they'll be inspired to want to do more for parents, right? And they may not realize that they aren't doing enough, that there are these gaps. If I'm listening to this and I want to put something in place for the working parents on my teams, what's something tangible, specific, that would be very useful and appreciated by working parents?
Childcare. Do something on childcare. And I'm not telling you to go build a childcare center. You know, if you can do that, great. But do something. It might just be providing backup care, like not penalizing flexibility or remote work when there's a crisis, or when you just want to spend a little more time with your kids. It's providing childcare subsidies. I really think that the thing that families are going to care about, especially this millennial generation, is how you treat their families. It's not going to be about like, do they have the best snacks? You know what I mean? Or pay for my gym membership. It's going to be like, can I actually be an active dad? Can I take Johnny to school or be coach of his little league or take time when he's sick? And are you still going to offer me my promotion? Are you still going to value my work? Are you still going to value me? And valuing me means valuing my family and my family responsibilities and not forcing me to choose between those identities.
Why is it that people aren't connecting? The fact that, you know, women need to leave the workplace disproportionately to care for either for children or for like parents, et cetera, why is there not a connection between that and, you know, gaps that are causing the labor shortage? why is there not this connection that, hey, if I created more solutions for childcare, elder care, et cetera, maybe I could retain people and I could, whatever, have continuity, have leadership, I have promote people and also maybe help tackle some of these long-term issues that we're going to be seeing with labor shortages?
Yeah, listen, I mean, it's a really great question because the thing is I would argue maybe before the pandemic, they didn't know. And the narrative we would tell ourselves, well, women just want to be at home with their kids. They're just, you know, once they have a baby, they just don't care about their careers as much. And now we have to realize, because we saw it on our Zoom screen, that is not the reality. And we've also seen that, like, we know what to do. We know that if you offer remote work or flexible work, that things will not end. Girls Who Code, 95% of my employees were women and they had babies. People had children all the time. We were the greatest. We know that Etsy, Patagonia, there's so many companies out there that have always centered families and children in childcare and paid leave, and they're crushing it from a productivity perspective. So it's a great question. Like, why is there resistance to this? And, you know, Claudia Golden, I think, talks about, she calls it greedy work, right? That, again, part of American culture is like you're always on, you're always available, you're working all the time, even if it's FaceTime. And so we have to, in some ways, let go of that a little bit and recognize that when there's life moments where people need that flexibility and that time, and that might mean It's the first 5 years of a child's life that parents need that too. It's only a gender thing because I think it's like we've been doing the unpaid labor, and from a societal perspective, they see that as our responsibility. But I think what's shifting is that in heterosexual couples in particular, I would argue, is like they're telling you that they want something different, and they want to basically both genders want to be able to spend time with their kids.
2024, we have a year ahead. In a lot of ways, the annual meeting helps sort of like get people thinking about what is the agenda for the next year. We've seen there's a host of risks from our global risks report. But in your mind, what are you worried about? What do you want to move forward this year that will set us up for the next decade or two?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think we can't keep having conversations about gender inequality without centering care. Period. Right. And I think that there's been so many conversations we've had about upskilling or the technology gap or skills gap. I think if we can commit to say we're actually globally going to make policy changes on care and then quantify what the impact of that is on women's labor market participation, that would be incredible.
How would the world be different in 10, 20 years if we actually got that commitment?
I mean, you wouldn't have a gender gap, period. You'd have full participation of women in the labor force. You know, you wouldn't have a poverty gap with children because children would be getting adequate care. You wouldn't be bankrupting global economies because they haven't done anything on elderly care, which is coming, right? And so kind of all of these crises that we're either in the middle of, you know, we're at the cusp of, either are not going to happen or are going to be fixed because we've centered care.
That was Reshma Sojani. Thanks so much to her, and thanks so much to you for listening. Find a transcript of this episode, as well as transcripts from my colleagues' episodes of Radio Davos at wef.ch/podcasts. If you like this episode, please let us know. Take a moment to rate and review us. We would love to hear from you. This episode of Meet the Leader was produced and presented by me, with Juan Toran as studio engineer and Gareth Nolan driving studio production. That's it for now. I'm Linda Lucina from the World Economic Forum. Have a great day.